Welcome to the Sanctuary Life Podcast, where we take you through a day in the life of animal rescues and sanctuaries across the country. Whether you are an experienced sanctuary staffer, one of the countless volunteers who work so hard at sanctuaries each day, or someone who just loves animals, we hope this journey can give you a behind-the-scenes peek into just what it takes to live the sanctuary life. Now, here's your host, Brandon Feisner, co-founder of Louisville, Kentucky's Butterfly Valley Rescue and Sanctuary.
This week, we bring you a very special aquatic edition of the Sanctuary Life Podcast in honor of my favorite week of the year, Shark Week. Shark Week, which originally launched 35 years ago on July 17, 1988 on the Discovery Channel, is the longest running cable television programming event in history. And Shark Week was launched to captivate and educate while countering some of the negative representations of shark in popular culture, and to provide viewers with shows that explored some of sharks, their strength, their magnificence, and the importance that they play in our oceans. And we just wanted to share a few shark facts for those of you joining us in all the excitement this week in celebration of our amazing finned friends. While most sharks would be 100% fine if they stopped swimming, a few of those iconic species that kind of everyone knows, the great whites, the whale sharks, hammerheads, mako sharks, most people don't realize it, but those sharks would actually suffocate and drown without forward motion or a strong current flowing towards their mouths. And because a shark's pectoral fins can't bend upwards like other fish, sharks are actually limited to forward movement only. So no worries if you're ever behind a shark. Sharks cannot go in reverse. They only go one direction. And most people don't realize it, but globally, cows on average cause 20 to 22 deaths per year, which actually means that you are 4 to 5 times more likely to be killed by a cow than a shark. And sadly, there are nearly 100 million sharks killed every year for their meat and fins alone. And nearly 50 million additional sharks are killed each year senselessly as part of the commercial fishing industry when they're caught or killed during other commercial fishing that's occurring for other species. So in brighter news this week, we venture from the world of farmed animal sanctuaries that we kind of have been in the last few episodes, and we go underwater to celebrate some of our finned friends. And we are joined by Gwendolyn Church, founder of Friends of Philip Fish Sanctuary, a 501c3 nonprofit fish and aquatic animal sanctuary in Reno, Nevada. So, Gwendolyn, thank you so, so much for joining us today, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Brandon. Thank you so much for having me.
So, can you tell us a little more about how, or a little bit about how, Friends of Philip Fish Sanctuary got started, and that story of that one little super skinny pale little fish at the back of that pet store shelf that kind of inspired you to do so much to help aquatic species?
Of course. Yeah. So as you mentioned, you know, it started with the one fish, who of course was Philip. That's where the name comes from. And, you know, really where I was at the time was about 4 years ago. And I had been vegan for a while. I'd been volunteering at a farmed animal sanctuary for a while. And I knew that I wanted to be more directly involved in animal rescue. But at the time, I didn't really feel like I had the resources in the space to rescue the more traditionally thought of farm species, you know, chickens, pigs, cows, et cetera. And so I came across a story on this website called Reddit, where someone had, you know, shared that they saw a really sick betta fish on the shelf of a large chain pet store, and they were able to rescue that fish for free. And so, you know, I might not have had the space for some of the larger terrestrial animals, but I certainly had the space for an aquarium and a single fish. And so I thought that it would be excellent to kind of learn all about fish care and betta care and aquariums, and set up an aquarium and have it ready so that if I came across a fish in a store who needed help, I could help them. at the time, I was incredibly naive about the true nature of the pet industry and how exploitative and cruel it is to all animals involved in it, and to fishes in particular. I thought it would take me a while to find a sick fish who needed help. And now I know that it can sometimes be easier to find a fish who needs help than it is to find one who doesn't, in the pet industry, because of how exploited and mistreated they are. So, you know, I came across Philip, and at the time I didn't actually have an aquarium set up, but I did have a very thorough understanding of aquariums and fish care and the nitrogen cycle and all the things that you need to know to have a healthy aquarium. And so I would never in a million years suggest that people take in an animal if they don't have the setting kind of, you know, ready for them. But I also knew at that moment that it was either coming home with me or dying in a pet store for Philip. And so I asked the manager if I could take him home. They said yes. I ran to a different store and bought all the equipment that I needed, and then got him home and kind of started getting things moving. From there, I got to see Philip recover fantastically and become a healthy, thriving fish. And that kind of motivated me to just start helping other fish. It felt like one of those things that, because I had the space and the knowledge and the resources to do this, I just kind of needed to. And it was never a question of helping more bettas and more fish in general if I could. So, you know, things just kind of grew organically from the first tank there. And pretty quickly I had multiple aquariums running in what was at the time a one bedroom kind of flat. And so, you know, just steadily adding aquariums here and there and bringing in more fish over time. But the idea to turn it into an organization and actually, you know, start to advocate more for fishes started a couple years after that. And then, of course, just recently, we finally became a 501c3. So it's been a little bit of a saga, but it's grown organically and at a pace, I think, that has kept it safe and sustainable and exactly where it needs to be.
Yes, and although fish don't necessarily need as much space as when you think of the traditional species that we have kind of talked about so far on the podcast, with chickens and cows and things like that, goats, fish do still need a lot more space than what kind of is traditionally recommended in storage.
Oh, absolutely.
We will definitely touch on some of those topics as we go. So now that we've learned a little more about how Friends of Philip got started, tell us a little more about how things are today and what that very first fish rescue, before you even had the tank ready, because there was such a need. What is that? How many current species do you have care for? How many tanks do you have? What does that look like now?
Yeah, so we have an entire room now dedicated to the fish, and we creatively call it the fish room, but it has about 25, 26 aquariums in there at any given time. It can vary a little bit because we may or may not have individuals in quarantine. And so if we have fishes in quarantine, then of course it's an additional tank. But we care for over 25 species of fish and aquatic animals. And we have a couple terrestrial species thrown in there as well. We have two geckos. We have three permanent resident chickens and two additional chickens who live with us currently. So, you know, we have many more species living here than a typical farmed animal sanctuary might. But most of those species live peacefully in community tanks with multiple species. So the smaller species like corydoras and things like that can live in an aquarium that they share with other species, which is great. But yeah, like you mentioned, they definitely don't take as much space as, say, like a cow or something like that. But they definitely do need more space than people might typically believe. So We have our room dedicated to the small kind of tropical fish species. And then we also have a number of stock tanks dedicated to goldfish and other cold water species or temperate species. And additionally, this year we're looking at putting in a pond in ground outside for the goldfish. So that'll dramatically expand the amount of space that they have and will open up additional capacity for us to take in goldfish, which will be great. Because goldfish are, you know, by far one of the species most in need when you're looking at pet fish species. And so, you know, today we have far more tanks than we started with, and we're looking at the ponds and everything like that. So it's grown a lot. But, you know, always with the mind of keeping it sustainable and manageable for the amount of resources and time that I really have to dedicate to it.
Yes, and I think I love that you talk about keeping the goldfish in ponds and in stock tanks, because that is, there's this massive misconception out there in the pet trade amongst anyone that doesn't know and understand fish, that goldfish can live in those little single bowls that you see them sold in at fairs and so many other places that they're exploited in, and that is absolutely not the case. Goldfish and koi and some of those others need vastly more space than so many other species do.
Oh yeah, they get huge, and that's part of why. So that, you know, they consume a lot of food, they produce a lot of waste, and they just grow to be enormous compared to a lot of the more typical small tropical species. So your classic common goldfish that you could win at a fair or buy from a pet store for 17 cents or something like that, that fish can grow to over a foot long and live for 20 years or more. And most people don't realize that because their experience of goldfish is one who died in a bowl after a few months. And that's just tragic.
Yes. Yeah, so I know you said now you have 25 or 26 aquariums currently, but about a year and a half ago, you all made a big move from Sonoma County, California, there to Reno, Nevada. And how much of an adventure was it to prep and move all the aquatic residents? Because it's much different than moving, say, a cat or a dog or even farmed animal species. Moving fish and other aquatic species require a lot of work. What are kind of some things that you had to take into consideration that most people don't think about?
It's a great question, and it was definitely an adventure. We were really lucky that, you know, previously I was renting from family, and so there wasn't a need to move by this hard date or anything like that going on. We were able to kind of do it in stages. But yeah, essentially for aquatic animals, the most significant consideration in basically any situation is always going to be water quality. And so, you know, it's the same way that a terrestrial animal and humans need a clean environment where we have access to fresh air, clean water, fresh food, clean bedding, and, you know, are not kind of stuck in a tiny space filled with waste. It's the exact same thing for fishes and aquatic animals. And the really significant difference is that for aquatic life, you know, they're living in water constantly, of course, and that water contains their waste. It contains all of the, you know, the things they produce. When they breathe, they produce ammonia, and when they, you know, create waste, that produces ammonia and things like that. So with any aquatic animal in an environment like a temporary thing, like we moved a bunch of fish in buckets, we had to be really careful about the water quality and not having too many fish in the buckets and things like that. And then on top of that, of course, there's the general stress of moving, which is hard on any animal. But for fish in particular, they can't look outside and see that they're moving. They don't know where they are or what's going on. And moving can be very stressful for them, of course, too, because when you're driving in a car, you know, we're all used to the swaying and the motion of the car, but that motion is felt even more strongly by the fishes in the water as the water starts to slosh around. So, you know, we tried to drive very carefully, kind of keep that in mind, and really just moving them as quickly as possible from point A to point B to make sure that we kept the water quality as good as possible, which isn't too hard if you have one or two fish that you're moving. But, you know, we moved at the time, we had probably 15 or 16 aquariums, along with two stock tanks with goldfish. And so moving all of them was definitely an undertaking. We did it in a few trips. We moved in November, right before, you know, right at the start of winter. And so we actually were able to leave the goldfish in Sonoma County until spring, which was great because they would not have been prepared for the much colder winter here in Reno compared to Sonoma County. So, you know, there were a lot of things that went into it, and we did multiple trips specifically for the animals. We moved all of our stuff and then came back and moved all the animals separately so that we could really focus on getting them here safely and knowing that we were keeping it as stress-free as possible. And, you know, a lot of the time in kind of the fish keeping hobby, if you will, people will talk about the inevitable losses, and loss during transport is one of those things where people just kind of accept that fish will die. And that's completely unacceptable to me and should be unacceptable to everyone. And we didn't lose any fish during our move. And we've never lost fish from transport, except for in one situation where they were incredibly sick to begin with. And so, you know, it's very doable to move fish safely so long as you're giving them the proper consideration and care.
Yes. And I think one thing that, again, if you're not familiar with fish and aquariums and the nitrogen cycles and everything that go into it, the whole other aspect of that is then taking tanks from one location, setting them up at another location, and making sure that you don't completely kill any cycle and things that you had going, and trying to maintain that so that those fish have a healthy environment moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. The cycle mostly lives in the filter. And so of course, you know, you said the nitrogen cycle, which is what processes ammonia and nitrite from fish waste into nitrate, which is safer for fishes and aquatic life. And yeah, if you let those filters dry out, or if they aren't running for too long, then that cycle will die. And now you have to do what's called a fish-in cycle, which is an incredibly labor-intensive and potentially dangerous process for the fish in the aquarium. So anything that you can do to avoid that is definitely ideal. And yeah, we were able to, you know, basically it was the filters and the fish were the last thing that we put in the car to leave, and the first thing that we pulled out of the car when we got here. And we got the filters running, even just in the buckets, as quickly as we could to maintain that that nitrogen cycle and keep the fish safe.
Yes. So obviously anyone who spends any time getting to know your organization, you through social media, will see how big of a role betta fish play in your sanctuary life, and going all the way back to Philip. And what can you tell our listeners about bettas to help them better understand them?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And bettas are incredible animals. You know, I kind of think of betta fish as the pugs of the fish world. You know, we all know the health issues that selectively bred animals like dogs, especially, you know, pugs, bulldogs, all those short-nosed breeds and things, the health issues that they encounter as a result of that selective breeding. Bettas are just like them, essentially. They encounter endless health issues because of the way they've been bred to look. And bettas are bred en masse for specific appearances with no regard to their health or longevity. And so I think, you know, the biggest thing that it's important for people to know about bettas, and really it applies to any fish, but is that they are not suited for life in a bowl or in a tiny tank, the way pet stores and the pet industry will lead you to believe. You know, the absolute smallest tank that we keep a betta in permanently is 5 gallons, and really 10 gallons is even better. And, you know, bettas can survive in a bowl. better than some fish species because they have a unique organ called a labyrinth organ that allows them to breathe air from the surface. And that organ was developed over, you know, millennia of evolution to allow bettas to survive through periods of drought. It's not something that, you know, that's not an ideal environment for them to be in, a tiny, tiny amount of water where they need to breathe air from the surface. They will always do better in a larger tank with a filter, with a heater, with, you know, plants and tunnels and caves and things that they can hide in and explore and live a more enriched life with. And really that applies to all fish, but I think the misperceptions around bettas in particular are so stark because of the way that they're sold and marketed in the pet trade as being, you know, the ideal fish to put in a little tiny container.
Yes. And like you said, I think when you walk into the stores and see them, you immediately see that, because unlike the other fish species that are at least in traditional tanks, often overcrowded, but at least in traditional tanks, and occasionally have some form of plants and things in those tanks, you walk over to where the bettas are kept and they're in these little tiny individual cups that in a lot of cases the water has not necessarily been changed since they were received at the store, and don't always have oxygen provided to them, and don't always, like, it is so tragic. And that's what most people that have never had them, that's the biggest understanding, or that's all they know of that species.
Exactly. Yeah. And those little cups are so tragic, and the pet stores and the pet trade will tell you that they have to be kept in those because they can't live together, which is true that you should not house bettas together. But they can often live with other peaceful community species. And the fact that they can't be kept together is not acceptable justification for keeping them in such horrendous conditions. And really those cups and the way that they're sold is a big part of the reason that they're so prevalent at our sanctuary. Oftentimes, you know, you go to a pet store, and I've never been to a pet store without seeing at least one or more dead fish. There's always someone who's died, and it's often a betta. But in those cups, it's easiest for them to, you know, I can go and I can literally take the fish off the shelf. I can go ask the manager if I can have this specific fish. And it's just much easier for the store to say, yeah, you can adopt that fish, as compared to, you know, if there's a fish in the tank who isn't doing well, I have to track someone down. I have to ask them about that specific fish and point them out, and they have to try to catch them. And there's a whole lot more involved, that makes it, unfortunately, quite a bit less likely in my experience that a store would be willing to surrender one of those fish from the tanks. And so for the bettas, it's just that it's a bit easier to have them, you know, for a store to be willing to surrender them, and also for, unfortunately, for them to be doing really terribly because they are in such a small amount of water with no filter.
Yes. And I know one common kind of topic that you have talked about throughout all of the different interviews and articles and everything else that I've seen that you've done that I think is so important for people to understand is that misconception that fish don't feel pain, and how that is still so tragically prevalent in society. And just like you talked about, walking into pet stores and you find, I mean, almost every single time you find at least one fish that is dead, and what that outrage would be if someone walked into a pet store and found a rabbit dead, or found a bird dead, or found a dog dead, or found any of those other, like, the outrage that would be there. But you walk into a pet store and find a fish dead, and it's just, unfortunately for most, so many people, it's just another day.
Oh, absolutely.
What is the one thing, talking about that misconception, fish not feeling pain, what is kind of that one thing out of that you want people, or you think that people should know most about fish that they likely don't know? And you may have already kind of covered that.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I come back to all the time with fish around this is that There are over 33,000 known species of fish. And those 33,000 species make up over 60% of the known vertebrate species on Earth. And it is astonishing then to consider the scale of the assumptions that we're making about fish. Because within that enormous range of species, there are fish species who are as different from each other as cows are to dogs. You know, there's a huge, huge biological diversity in the fish world, in the aquatic world. And for us to have kind of the arrogance to say that fish don't feel pain or that they don't have experiences is just overwhelming with the scale of that kind of assumption. And, you know, we know unequivocally that fish feel pain. We know that they have experiences and that they seek to avoid pain. And it goes so much beyond that, that fish have social structures and family structures and, you know, are incredibly intelligent in ways that we can't comprehend because we aren't fish. And so to dismiss them so flippantly, I think is really a shame on us and our hubris, if you will. And, you know, I think it's so important for people to be aware of the scale of some of those assumptions when we're talking about fish and their experiences.
Yes. And underestimating you touched on it, the intelligence of fish. I know if people take the time and really wanted to see the things that fish are capable of, there are countless people out there that have truly taken the time and done training and things with fish, and especially goldfish and betas, that the things that you can teach those fish to do over time, it seems different than what you would teach it like a dog to do as far as tricks, because they're not out and interacting with you physically, like touching them, mm-hmm. but they're not that much different than what those fish are capable of.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, there's a really cute event that goes on social media called the Betta Olympics that I would encourage people to look into if they're curious about some of the things that fish can be taught. And, you know, it's caregivers for bettas who have taught their fish to jump through little hoops, who have taught them to weave through poles and do all kinds of tricks and interesting things, as you know, using the same kind of positive reinforcement training that can be used for any animal. And you know, I am not one really for competition and things around animals, but I think that the Betta Olympics in the grand scheme of things is doing more good than harm in that area, because it is showcasing the abilities of these animals and showing how intelligent they are and the relationships that can be formed with them.
Yes. So I wanted to see, is there, obviously we've talked about bettas and the role that they play in your sanctuary life. Is there another aquatic fish species or amphibian or invertebrate that we haven't talked about that you would say is one of your favorite species or has played a major role in what you've done? And what is it that makes them one of your favorites?
That's a hard question. They're all amazing in their different ways. But I think that goldfish would probably be one of my favorites, because they're just fascinating animals. They're incredibly social, and the social bonds that they build are just amazing to be able to facilitate and witness. We had two fancy goldfish named Lucas and Wednesday. Lucas is still with us, but Wednesday had passed away maybe 8 months or 9 months ago. And Lucas and Wednesday were living inside together, which we typically keep our goldfish in groups larger than two, because of this specific experience in part. But Wednesday had a lot of kind of developmental, and you know, she was disabled in a lot of ways because of the poor care that she had experienced before us. And so she had a lot of challenges with mobility and things like that, that meant that she couldn't live in a larger tank with our other fancy goldfish and deal with some of the more extreme temperatures that those tanks experience. And so she lived inside, and goldfish, like I said, are very, very social. So they really shouldn't be kept alone. And so when we brought in Lucas, he lived with Wednesday, because they were both black moors and fancy goldfish. And, you know, they just got along really well. And so these two were just the best of friends. And when Wednesday passed away, I genuinely thought Lucas was going to die as well. I have never seen grief like that in another animal. Lucas, when Wednesday died, he just completely shut down. He wouldn't eat. He was like laying on his side on the bottom of the tank. He was just so, so clearly deeply depressed and sad. And you know, I was freaking out because I'd never seen something like that before. And I was worried, you know, was there something wrong with the water quality? Was there something going on, you know, more in the background? But after about a week, he kind of started to come out of it. And when our vet came out and saw him, she confirmed that he was healthy and that she's seen that kind of grief response in goldfish before. And, you know, from that experience, I've very firmly said that, you know, with the potential exception of some disabled kind of, you know, situation similar to Wednesday's, I would never keep a goldfish or keep goldfish in pairs, because that loss and being alone is just too hard on them. And so seeing the lives and the bonds and the families that goldfish create, I think is just really, really incredible. And it kind of just, you know, brings me back to our general misunderstanding of fish and their experiences in their lives.
Yes, and I think the closest thing that for our listeners that maybe are traditionally more focused on farm animal species, and the closest thing that I would compare goldfish to would be pigs, and just the incredible, mm-hmm. like the emotion of them, like you said, that incredible social like hierarchy and the social bonds, and the same exact thing that you talked about with Lucas and. After Wednesday passed, you see the same exact thing in pigs. When if pigs are just in pairs and one passes, they literally will. I mean, essentially, you can see another pig die of heartbreak because they just won't function. And it's crazy. Like for most people to think of that in fish species, they would tell you that doesn't exist. But I think if you ever spend time with goldfish and watch them and obviously in your case, seeing that in person, it definitely changes your view about them as a whole.
Oh, absolutely.
So talking about some of the animals that the misconceptions and the difficulty dealing with like the pet industry. One project that I know that you have been a part of, and you have some incredible videos on your social media showing the issue with it, is being part of the effort to get a company called Froggy's Lair to stop selling these tiny biospheres, as they call them, in an effort to commercialize African dwarf frogs in toy stores, calling them like STEM experiments and everything, like to get these in toy stores to make money and commercialize that. With not keeping the health and everything else of the pet or even public health in that regard in mind. Can you tell us a little more about that project and if there's anything that our listeners can do to help with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few groups involved in that project. And it's exactly as you said. The company Froggy's Lair makes these biospheres and they're tiny. I mean, it's ridiculous how tiny these are. The one that we had, we measured that it holds 5 cups of water. And the company is saying that this is not only acceptable, but ideal for 2 frogs to live their entire lives in. And so, you know, for reference, I have 2 other African dwarf frogs who live in 16 gallons and they have tons of plants. They have a heater, a filter, and, you know, a much overall better life than the typical Froggy's Lair frog might experience. But yeah, it's really a pretty terrible product. It's in many ways, I think, worse than a lot of what you see in pet stores, because this is a thing that's sold in toy stores and marketed to children. And I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever met a child who would walk into a toy store to buy a toy and then learn that they could instead bring home two adorable live frogs and not want that much more. And so, you know, these frogs are just set up for lives of suffering and boredom and often starvation. You know, the care recommendations that the company provides are just abysmal. And so, yeah, there's a kind of ongoing effort to have those items removed from toy store shelves. There's an Instagram account called, I believe it's the Fish Keeping Teacher, and the person behind that, the Fish Keeping Teachers, sorry. The person behind that is a teacher, and he has an African clawed frog who he shares videos and you know, insight into as a way to show, you know, what proper care for an aquatic frog actually looks like. So that's a great account to kind of follow and follow their recommendations on what they're doing for ending this froggy's layer everything. And then the other organization is called Aquatic Ally. They're a nonprofit fish rescue and kind of welfare organization. They do a lot of things for advocating for aquatic life and fishes in general, but then they are also focused on Froggy's Lair. So both of those accounts are great. The Fish Keeping Teachers has a petition that is being circulated. And so that can be, you know, signed. And you know, really one of the big things with any of this is just continuing to raise awareness and talk to people about why this is unacceptable and why it's cruel. And, you know, so something that I would definitely encourage people to do is look in your area to see if you have any toy stores that are selling these products and contact those toy stores directly. A huge culprit in this is the toy store chain called Learning Express. You know, they are a chain where each place is individually owned. And so the corporate response has been, oh, we can't really, you know, control what individual stores are selling. So, you know, if you find out that there's a Learning Express in your area that sells Froggy's Lair or any live animals, I would strongly encourage people to contact those stores and, you know, raise public awareness around the fact that this is cruel. And it is, like you mentioned, also a health hazard. Amphibians are a known carrier of salmonella, and with proper precautions, it's perfectly easy to keep them safe and, you know, keep them healthy, keep you healthy. But the Froggy's Lair biosphere is not the ideal situation to avoid that, especially when it's marketed at children who want to be able to put their hands in things and interact with, you know, everything that's around them.
Yes. And we can definitely, I will try to tag both of those accounts in the show notes so that people can check out some of their videos and follow this project and hopefully help make an impact and make a difference and save the lives of some of these African dwarf frogs that are unfortunately winding up in just for very short, horrific lives. And so obviously running an aquatic sanctuary is very different than most other types of sanctuaries. You hear of the farmed animal, and you hear of dog, and you hear of cat, and chicken and other birds. What would you say would be the most difficult part of running an aquatic sanctuary?
I think that in general, the thing that people are going to find to be the biggest challenge, if like, say, you know, someone's interested in starting an aquatic animal sanctuary, the biggest challenge by far will be finding vet care. aquatic vets exist and they're necessary, but they are not common. So it can be very challenging to find them. Outside of that, I think that some of the challenges are really, you know, the startup and the learning curve of understanding aquariums and aquatic health and aquatic animals in general and their needs. You know, we talked about how I have over 25 species living at Friends of Philip in sanctuary. And that's a huge number of species compared to many sanctuaries. And every single one of those species has their own needs on top of the individualized needs of each individual, of course. And so, you know, as with anything, it's, I think, about starting small and only ever taking in animals who you know that you can keep and provide for their entire lives. But that can be really challenging with fishes and aquatic life because, you know, on one side you have guppies and minnows and some of these live bearing species who maybe live 1.5 to 2 or 3 years. And then on the other end of that spectrum, you have goldfish and koi who can live 20, 30 years or longer. And so there's this huge range of needs and differences in needs across the different species that can make it, you know, a little challenging in some ways, both to accommodate all the needs and to make sure that I have a full understanding of what they actually require. Because as with any animals, I think, you know, you find tons of misinformation online. And I think that for fishes in particular, that can be even worse, because you'll get, you know, if you Google any specific species, you'll see anything from, oh, they need a tank that's 15 gallons to no, they shouldn't be in anything smaller than 75. So there's a lot of like misinformation that you kind of have to sift through when you're trying to learn more about aquatic animal care and individual species care.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, like you talked about, with there's not many other animals that, like so many people will walk into a pet store, see this fish, they'll love this fish because it's a cute fish, and unfortunately, raising fish and doing that is so much different than any other animal. You cannot just buy a fish, and that's the hardest thing for people to understand is you cannot, without having a tank set up. I won't say you cannot, but you should not ever walk into a pet store and get a pet fish and take it home and then try to set up a tank. You are just, it is almost a death sentence if you are not experienced for that fish to attempt Absolutely. To do that. And that's the hardest thing for people to understand. And that I know here locally we see so often and the pet stores, unfortunately, it's a dollar to them. I mean, that's revenue. Whether that fish lives or dies, that they're making their dime. And so to them, exactly. It's not, they're not going to turn that customer away.
Yeah. And it's completely counter to their ultimate goal of making money, just like any business, to require that customers follow the proper needs of these fish. If every pet store said, no, you can't buy a fish until you have a fully cycled aquarium, and that takes 4 to 6 weeks, people would never buy fish, which would be good for the fish, but of course would not be good for the store. And so, yeah, sifting through that information and understanding what fish actually need can definitely be a challenge.
So one thing I know you mentioned in the last question that I'm glad you brought up is how difficult we know how difficult it can be to find knowledgeable and reliable veterinarians to treat our residents in a farmed animal species world. Anymore, it's becoming difficult to find veterinarians to treat just your normal, like cats and dogs and things like that, just because of the veterinarian mm-hmm. shortage. But when we're talking about, whether we're talking about species that are raised commonly for consumption, such as like cows and chickens and pigs, or species in the pet trade, such as fish and some of those other exotic animals. I know you've been blessed to have an amazing vet to help you with the care of those fish. How valuable has that been in allowing you to save so many lives?
It's been absolutely critical, to the point that I think, you know, taking in as many fish as we have and expanding the way we have would have been unethical. without access to that vet. We take in a lot of challenging cases where fish are unhealthy and have lived through really terrible experiences. And without a vet to kind of guide us and prescribe medication and treatment, it would not have been the right move to expand in that way and to take in those animals. You know, I know aquatic veterinary care is challenging to find. Just like, as you said, most veterinary care right now, but aquatic vet care in particular is uncommon. But it's absolutely critical to providing sanctuary and to providing care for these animals. You know, fishes and aquatic animals are just as worthy and deserving of medical care and treatment as any other animal. But unfortunately, in the fish trade and in the kind of, everyone calls it the hobby, the aquarium hobby, people will not only say that vet care is, you know, that they don't use vets, they will say that it's unnecessary, or pointless or anything like that, or outlandish is what I heard recently. And, that's just not the case, but you get a lot of kind of home treatments and people who claim to be experts on fish health and care. And you know, fishes are one of the only animals that we really do that with. You see it a lot in farming and things, unfortunately, as well. But as far as kind of pet species go, you know, there are exotic vets in places that will see reptiles and hamsters and, you know, rodents and rabbits and all of those kind of categories. But finding a fish vet is very hard. And you know, you can go to many specialty pet stores and just buy antibiotics, and people do that and they bring them home and they treat their fish without a diagnosis and without knowing if they're actually using the proper medication to treat the condition. And you don't really see that with other, you know, terrestrial species. And so, you know, it's been critically important to me and to Friends of Philip as part of our kind of one of our core principles really is that all animals deserve medical care. And so we would never have expanded as we have if we didn't have access to that vet. It wouldn't be the right thing to do.
Yes. And I think an important part of that is the difficulty and difference in, and I think that's something good to talk about in getting, like with your dog or your cat, you just load them in the car and you take them to the vet. And even mm-hmm. with farmed animal species, you load them in a trailer and take them to the vet. When it becomes fish or other aquatic species, then it becomes, you're back into the challenge that we talked about earlier with, then you're transporting that, the fish and the risks and things that come to that, or you're having a vet that will come to you, which again, yeah. finding an aquatic vet is hard enough. Finding an aquatic vet that will come to you is next to impossible.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And we really hit the jackpot on that. Because yeah, our vet, Dr. Sanders, she has a mobile service called Aquatic Veterinary Services. And so she's licensed in California and Nevada, but practices almost exclusively in California. And she makes the trek out to Reno for us to come see our residents, which is just incredible. And, you know, we're really lucky too, because, you know, any specialized vet care is going to be incredibly expensive. And Dr. Sanders, because we have so many residents and such a variety of species, she provides us care at an hourly rate. And that includes everything. You know, it's amazing to see the services she has. She has, she can do x-rays, she can do ultrasounds, all just from what is in the car that they have set up for this service. And so, you know, it's absolutely incredible that we have access to that. And, you know, I wish that were more widespread. There are more people going into aquatic vet care each year, but it's still a very, very underserved area of vet care.
Yes. And I think a lot of that is what you talked about earlier, is that misconception though, to where, why would you pay whatever the fee would be for that visit. Why would you pay hundreds of dollars to see like there's that misconception of why would you pay hundreds of dollars to see a vet for your fish when I can ride to the fish, when I can ride to the pet store and ask that worker in the fish section what I should do to treat that. And really, that could be a 19-year-old that has never kept fish in their whole life, and they're just going to walk you to some medicine on a aisle and say, here's what to use.
Here's this. Yeah. And then you take home an unregulated medication that, you know, and people are now exposing themselves to different antibiotics and all these different medications without a full understanding of what that actually is. You know, I think that that all medication really should be prescribed by a professional and someone who can tell you, yes, this is the correct medication to use. Here's the regulated specific medication that you need. Here's the dosing information. Here's what you need to be aware of, so you know what you're working with, and you know, you can go from there. And that's always going to be the best way to provide medical care.
Yes. So last July, Friends of Philip kind of expanded, as you talked about briefly earlier, with some of your residents, and jumped out of the water to welcome three new terrestrial residents, Gracie, Lucille, and Annabelle. Can you tell us more about them and how they went from a home that was threatening to, I know that the term you used from the Craigslist ad was threatening to terminate them within 3 days if they ran out of food. And how they went from that environment to being the first feathered friends of your sanctuary, and what kind of that has looked like and how that's changed things.
Yeah, absolutely. So this little trio, they are adorable. They're best friends and they do everything together, which is just so sweet. But yeah, Gracie, Lucille, and Annabelle, they're three Rhode Island white hens is what we believe their breed to be. But yeah, I just, you know, one of the ways that we bring in aquatic residents is through Craigslist, because often people don't really know how to rehome fishes and aquatic animals. And so they'll list them like for free on Craigslist because they have a tank that they don't want anymore and they're ready to not have fish and they don't really know what to do with them. So I tend to browse Craigslist a bit and I came across the ad for them. It was an older man who had chickens. He didn't have any more chickens, and I don't think was planning to get any more, but he had these three ladies. He said they'd stopped laying eggs, and he was going to, as he said, terminate them when he ran out of food, which was just kind of shocking to me that that's the way that people treat animals. But so I saw them there, and I just couldn't let that happen to them. I've always really, really loved chickens. And so, you know, when we moved here and now that we have this house with a yard and everything, I knew that we would eventually have chicken residents as well. And so seeing these three, the initial plan was to bring them in, foster them, and then rehome them to a sanctuary in California, which is where I had volunteered previously. And we brought them in and fostered them. And I just kind of fell in love with these three girls and wanted to keep them here. And so we, you know, had them in a nice, secure kind of foster setup and really just jumped on building the run for them. Our house has a few sheds in the yard, and we decided to dedicate one of those to the chickens quite early. So we already had kind of the coop selected and all of that, and we really just needed to build them a nice predator-proof run. So we that's continued to be surprising to me is that in Reno, we have much harsher winters here than in Sonoma County where I grew up. And the weather routinely doesn't go above the teens, during the day in winter. I've never met anyone here who keeps chickens who has a heated coop or anything to truly protect them from the elements. And that was pretty shocking to me. So, one of the things we did after the chickens had been here for a few months was to run electricity out to that shed so that we can run a heater for them in winter and keep them warm. Because of course they should be warm. So having the three girls has been just wonderful. I deeply love chickens. I think they're incredible animals and just so horribly mistreated. So to be able to provide sanctuary for these three has been incredible, and to see them really, you know, continue to live their lives and love life. And they do. And it's wonderful to facilitate that.
But Gracie, Lucille, and Annabelle aren't your only feathered residents right now. I know you brought up earlier that you all just welcomed in, for the time being at least, two new rescued chickens, Sammy the rooster and Becca the hen. What can you tell us about them?
Yeah, they're new. It was kind of a similar situation. We're listed on Craigslist. And this was a bit of a different situation. The person had many other chickens and, you know, unfortunately, I think is continuing to exploit them. But Sammy was listed as a 4-month-old rooster who was ready to be killed to eat. And Becca is a 2-year-old hen who was also listed to be killed to eat because she has stopped laying eggs. And so, you know, roosters are incredibly, incredibly hard to find placement for, as I'm sure you and everyone listening knows, because there's so much stigma against roosters and their crowing. So we were super lucky to find a sanctuary in Oregon that will be taking in Sammy. So I'm just working on transport for him. And then we're likely going to keep Becca here as a permanent resident, you know, and be able to integrate her into the group with Gracie, Lucille, and Annabelle. I think that she'll do well. They, you know, they've all lived in groups and everything before. And so, of course, if we were to encounter issues or anything where Becca was not going to be a good fit, we will look at placing her with a different sanctuary. But either way, they're both safe, which is fabulous. And we're looking at getting Becca into the vet as soon as possible, because of course it's not normal for a 2-year-old hen to have completely stopped laying eggs. And so we're concerned about reproductive disease or something else going on with Becca, unfortunately.
Yes. And it's amazing with chickens, how quickly people are to discard them. And it's really mm-hmm. sad, especially roosters being where you see that most commonly, and that people go to their feed store, go to their Tractor Supply or wherever that may be, and buy their chicks when they're really cute. Yep. And they're a few days old, and they get home and suddenly 4 out of those 6 chicks that they just bought are roosters, and they don't know what to do with 4 roosters.
Exactly. And then, they're given away for free or anything like that. And in this situation, it kind of just broke my heart that we went and picked up these 2 birds, and the person we picked them up for didn't even ask what we were going to do with them. There was absolutely no concern. You know, it was like we were going to pick up a bookshelf. This person just didn't care at all what our intentions were for these animals. And you see that so often with animals in these situations of like you said, roosters who came as, you know, little baby chicks, or with fish or any of the animals who are listed on places like Craigslist and things, that some people truly are doing their best to find a good home, and they'll ask questions and they'll be diligent about it. And then you get the opposite side of that, of people who just want the animal gone and they don't care what happens to them. And it's just heartbreaking. It puts so many animals in such terrible situations.
Yes. So having both chickens and then your aquatic residents that you're used to, what would you say is one of the biggest similarities between them? Obviously, both being both fish and chickens being 2 of the most exploited species anywhere, like on the planet, bar none. Mm-hmm. And that's worldwide. That's not just in the US, that's everywhere. What would you say though, from like a personality standpoint and from all of that, that is kind of the biggest similarity between the chickens and your aquatic residents?
I think the biggest similarity has to be the curiosity with which they approach the world. you know, anything new that comes into the chicken area or that they see or anything is something to be learned about and experienced. And they want to experience that. And they're curious about the world and the things around them. Just endlessly curious, you know, very, very childlike in that way that I think if they could speak our language, they would constantly be asking like, why, what is that? What's over there? What's happening? Why is this going on? You know, and that's the way that they experience the world, which is something unique and new to learn about. And fishes are the same way. You know, I try to put new things into their tanks and change things around and keep things interesting for them so that they, you know, have some variety. And anything new that comes into the tank, the fish are just there wandering like, what is this? What's going on? What's this new thing? Or who is this new fish who just moved in? Or, you know, what's going on over there? Or when is the person going to bring us food? And there's just this constant amazing curiosity and the way that they interact with the world.
Yes. So what would you say, looking forward, that the future holds, or what do you hope that the future holds for Friends of Philip Fish Sanctuary? Where do you see kind of yourself moving forward? And do you all have plans to add additional terrestrial residents now that you have some feathered friends?
I think around the terrestrial residents, we're probably pretty content with where we're at right now. I've always had kind of in the back of my mind that it would be amazing to be able to provide sanctuary to pigs. But we don't currently have the space for them. And, you know, I adore pigs. And, you know, as we talked about with goldfish, I think, you know, the reasons that I love goldfish are very much the reasons that I love pigs as well. But fundamentally, I think that I want to keep the focus as much on fishes and aquatic life as I can. You know, there are a number of amazing micro sanctuaries that also either have fish residents or focus on fish, and that's incredible. But fishes are so underrepresented in kind of the sanctuary world and the animal advocacy world in general. And, you know, like you said, they're easily the most exploited animal on the planet. I mean, we as a species, we consume billions of terrestrial animals every year. And for fishes, that number is in the trillions. And that's just absolutely staggering and incomprehensible. And so, you know, I think keeping the focus on them is very critical. And, you know, to date, the sanctuary has been very focused on pet fish species. And really, that's largely due to space constraints. You know, I don't have the space for fish like bass or something like that. But I do very much want to expand to include species of fish that are exploited for food, because, you know, the atrocities in the pet trade are numerous and terrible, and affect, you know, countless fish every year. And then the you know, farming of fish for food and the wild capture of fish for food is very similar to the pet industry, just on a much, much larger scale. And so, you know, we are, of course, a vegan organization and want to advocate for ending the consumption and commodification of fishes and animals across all areas. So I really want to expand into some of the fish, you know, some of the fish species exploited for food. I think the most likely kind of food species that we would bring in the soonest would be tilapia, because they are, you know, on the smaller side of those kinds of species, and have care requirements pretty similar to some of the other species we have. So that's, you know, in terms of residents, that's one of the directions that I want to go next, is those species exploited for food. And for the sanctuary as a whole, you know, we just became a 501c3, and I really want to start more outreach directly in our community here. You know, I know a fish tank, or unfortunately a fish bowl, is like a very common kind of classroom pet and things like that. So I would love to create some programs to provide outreach to classrooms and teachers. And, you know, if they have a fish who currently lives in their classroom, to help them provide a better environment for that fish, or, you know, just ways to kind of connect with the community and, you know, the young people in our community in particular, to help advocate for fish and change people's perspectives of them.
Yes. And I think one of the big things that, that you talked about as far as, with that, like exploitation and talking about both the pet trade and then the food industry and fish, is that, that for every one fish that they're going after, whether that's, again, whether that's like commercial fishing, whether that's to capture fish for the pet trade, whatever that may be, for every one fish they're capturing, unfortunately, there are handfuls or numerous other species of fish that are impacted by that, whether that be that they are directly caught in nets and things of that nature during that that capture process, or whether it be that that the removal of some of those species from that environment offsets the balance there and causes loss of life and food sources and things for other species. So it's one of those things that a lot of people don't, I don't think, understand the impact that, that whether, again, it's a food choice you're making as far as what you're putting on your plate or not, or whether it's a choice of going to that pet store and choosing that fish to put in a tank, what the impact of that is on other species as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the problems of bycatch are horrible, to say the least, you know, and it's interesting because I feel like bycatch in general gets a lot more attention from kind of the general media than the fishing industry as a whole. Because, you know, unfortunately for the fishes, but, you know, turtles and dolphins and many of these animals who are affected by bycatch are much more beloved than fishes and kind of society as a whole. And so, you know, that's a horrible, horrible problem. And it's exacerbated, you know, the effects of fishing are exacerbated by the sheer amount of plastic waste and things that come from the fishing industry that are left in the oceans. And so even if an animal isn't dying directly by being caught in the net with fishes, they may very well be tangled in the net and drown without anyone ever knowing, because they, you know, were caught in a net that was cut from a boat when it was caught on a reef or something and left in the water. And so the effects of all that are just kind of endless and very pervasive. They just exist all over the world and are absolutely devastating to aquatic life and the health of the oceans and the world in general.
Yes. So if someone, one of our listeners, wants to find out more information about Friends of Philip Fish Sanctuary, where can they do so?
Our Instagram is probably the best place. It's Friends of Philip _ Fish Sanctuary. And then we have a Facebook page as well that's just Friends of Philip. So either of those I try to post regularly to social media. Sometimes I'm not as consistent as I would like to be, but I do post there regularly with updates on the residents. And, you know, I really encourage people, if they have a fish or know of someone who has a fish, who they have any questions about the care that the fish is receiving or anything like that, to send us messages and ask about that. I try to respond to those as quickly as I can, because there's just so much misinformation online around the proper care for these animals. And so, you know, anything we can do to provide more clarity and information around that is going to be helpful.
Yes, and we will make sure to link both your Facebook and Instagram in the show notes so that people can easily access those. And then lastly, what else can our listeners do to help support Friends of Philip and help you continue to provide life-saving care to these amazing fish and other aquatic animals that call Friends of Philip home?
So through our social media, we have a few places to donate to help support their care. We have a PayPal and a Patreon, and PayPal is, I believe it's Friends of Philip. I would have to check and confirm. Let me find on my link here. There's a link in the Instagram bio. Sorry. There's a link in the Instagram bio that has all of the donation spots. I never remember them off the top of my head, unfortunately. But yeah, PayPal or Patreon is the easiest way to donate to directly help support them. And you know, if people aren't in the position to donate, just helping to share any of the social media posts or any of the information in general, you know, just talking to the people in your lives about aquatic animals and their experiences can help, you know, to just slowly kind of change our perspective of these amazing animals.
Yes. And Gwendolyn, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank you so much for everything that you were doing there at Friends of Philip Fish Sanctuary. You're making a difference both there with the animals that call that home, and you're helping make a difference, I think, for as you said, unfortunately, for the fish hobby as a whole, and at least making sure that people are educated and understand and are providing a proper home for as many of these species as possible, because that is an area that, like you said, there's a huge lack of education. So we appreciate everything that you have done there. And kind of to end, to give it that Shark Week goodbye, as comedian and actor Tracy Morgan once said, we remind you and all of our listeners this week and every week to live every week like it's Shark Week. So thank you for joining us so much.
Thank you, Brandon. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Sanctuary Life Podcast, presented by Butterfly Valley Rescue and Sanctuary. To find out more about our podcast and how you can be a part of it, visit our webpage at butterflyvalleyrescue.com/podcast or join us on social media at Sanctuary Life Podcast. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please remember to download the episode and recommend us to family and friends. See you next time.